Booster.
Go.
Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Well, and greetings, everyone, from Florida's Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I am Jim Behnke, and this is the March 26th, 2011 edition of Space Talk, brought to you by Space Florida, committed to expanding Florida's aerospace enterprise. We're so glad to have you along on a Saturday afternoon here on Florida's Space Coast. And those for you who are listening online at WMMBAM.com from anywhere, really, on the internet, appreciate having you along today. We're going back to the moon today on today's edition of Space Talk as we continue to consider the future directions of our space program, which ways we can go and why are the reasons we might go a particular way. President Obama told us just about a year ago that as far as he was concerned, when we were talking about the moon, it was a been there, done that kind of thing. I have not agreed with that from day one. And I'm going to have a guest on today in the second and third segments of our show. A little bit later on, Dr. Paul Spudis of the Lunar and Planetary Institute in Houston. I know couldn't disagree more also with the premise that we are done with the moon. He spent his life studying our nearest neighbor in the sky, and a man who has routinely held lunar samples in his hands and worked with Apollo and on every moon mission you can think of around the world for the last few years. Is going to talk to us about why we might want to go back to the moon, and he has written a book that we'll talk about also that's fascinating, even on its own right, even if it was a totally different topic than the space program. It's an interesting book that he has put out here and published with the help of Apogee Books, our good friends up in Canada, who do such a remarkable job in publishing so many space-related titles to keep those of us who are interested in the program up to date on what's going on and a chance to read about things that we might not otherwise know about and collect on our shelves and have as reference material. Outstanding work. In the meantime, what's on your mind this week when it comes to our space program? Do you think we should be going back to the moon? Do you think we should be going straight to Mars? What about the asteroids? Maybe we shouldn't even be going into space at all. If you want to challenge me with that notion, feel free to do so as well. But in any case, your calls and conversations and contributions to this program, always welcome. Our phone numbers to reach us, 321-768-1240, gets you here from anywhere in the world. Star 1240 is the number to punch in if you're a local AT&T wireless customer here on the Space Coast. That's a free phone call right into the studio. And if you're more comfortable with email, if you just soon send us something on the internet, our email address is spacetalking@aol.com. So just send us a note there, and you will have no problem getting right to us. A couple of things happening in space this week that I want to call your attention to. And the first one, I think it's the lead item in the news this week, is that NASA on Thursday ended its Stardust mission. Stardust was a probe that was launched on a Delta II rocket from Cape Canaveral Air Force Station right here at the Cape. Where else would you launch a probe to another planet than right here? In February of 1999, it took off and began its long, long journey. And through the years, its main job was to go to the comet called Wild 2 and recover stardust, literally recover dust from deep space, from the comet, and hence its name, and return that sample to the Earth. And so here you had a spacecraft with essentially two pieces to it, and the one piece would go fly through, well, basically the whole thing would fly through this dust and collect it. And if you recall, remember, this was, you know, 1999, a long time ago, is when we were first introduced to this concept called aerogel. Remember the aerogel? It's in such practical use today now in so many ways, but it was basically brand new. And it's if you think of aerogel, a lot of times they call it solid air. It's extremely lightweight, extremely not dense. I don't know what the opposite of the word dense is, thin, whatever. And the idea here is that these dust particles moving so fast would get slowed down just enough and trapped into this aerogel that then this material would be returned to Earth in a capsule, and then the scientists could pluck these little stardusts out of the aerogel and study them. And indeed, that's what they did. It was a complete success of a mission. On Thursday, they had their final kind of mission activity. And I think it was also interesting, too, that even to the very end, you know, NASA and the science teams find ways to learn more about what can help in the next mission, the next time we fly up there. You know, when you launch a spacecraft out like this, like a probe to another planet, you know, you fill up the tank with gas, whatever that gas may be, hydrazine or whatever. And then as you fly that mission and you make these little maneuvers, these little burns, you know, you can calculate as best you can how much fuel got used, you know, in maneuvering your spacecraft. But you don't ever really know exactly how much is in the storage container when you're done. It's not as precise as you would think. You've got liquid floating, you know, in microgravity, and you've got sensors that wear out, and you've got other just general issues. It's just generally a tough thing to do, is to know exactly how much you have. And so what the Stardust people did on Thursday, in it's sort of its last hurrah of an event, is they fired the thrusters on the Stardust and just kept them open, just kept them firing to the very end until all it was called a burn to depletion. So they're going to burn all of the gas off in this probe until there's nothing left. And by doing so and measuring the acceleration and all that in the probe, you could tell exactly how much was in the tanks for real versus what you predicted had been in there all the time. And by comparing those differences, then go back through your system and figure out where you were good and where you were bad. And so you put all that together, and of course I don't have the results to all that yet, but that was its final hurrah. So they burned the thrusters to depletion, they emptied the tank, and then they literally just, after they sent the data back, it was just throwing a switch and turning the spacecraft off to let it go do its thing, which is a big, huge solar orbit just forever circling in our solar system. The other neat thing about Stardust was that, if again, you consider that it was 1999 when it launched. In 1997, 96, 98, somewhere in that late time frame there, as we were getting more and more used to the Internet, and the Internet was really exploding for everyone to use, this was the first kind of NASA program where you could put your name on a spacecraft. You could go to the website that they had set up at the time and then enter your information, your name and your family's names and where you're from and all that. And then I think you could even spit out a certificate at that time. You certainly became part of the database. And they took all those names and etched them on a little wafer, actually two little wafers on two different parts of the spacecraft, and sent them up there. And so my name and my family's name and a lot of my friends' names and perhaps yours are up there on that Stardust probe to circle, you know, the universe forever. Anybody want to check you out at some point with your name up there? Don't know if that'll ever happen, but it was a really cool, novel thing to do that really got the public involved in everything. Well, anyways, so farewell, Stardust. You did great. And enter another successful mission to the history books. When we come back, more about going back to the moon with Dr. Paul Sputis calling in from Houston. This is Jim Banky. You're listening to WMMB.
With everything you need to know about America's space program, here is Jim Behnke.
And welcome back, everybody, to Space Talk, brought to you by Space Florida. Boy, I don't know how much time I want to spend with a lot of background here, because I want to get right to our guest, but I do need to sort of set this up, remind everyone that 2004, let's go back to 2004, largely as a response to one of the recommendations of the Columbia Accident Investigation Board. As you know, our nation's space policy was changed at that point, President Bush getting up, announcing the vision for space exploration, which, of course, that was 6 years ago. That was, well, even more than 6 years ago now, as it seems. We're talking about finishing the space shuttle program, assembly of the space station, building a new rocket, new system to replace the shuttle, going back to the moon, and then on to Mars and other destinations that are out there. In the ensuing years that followed, the argument started. What kind of a rocket? What's the true destination? What do we really need to go back to the moon for? Do we need to go back to the moon? Why not go directly to Mars? And then Congress is worried about, well, what if we cancel this program? How many jobs is that going to be? We cancel that program. How many jobs is that going to be? Well, you know, and the debate goes on and on and on, and the space community gets involved. And can't even seem to agree among itself what to do. It's almost like we were given a silver platter, whatever we wanted almost. Here's the budget. Here's the open vision. Now go do something neat for once. I don't want to say it's imploded, but it's not solved yet. We still don't know where we're going and why. But along the way comes the introduction of blogging into the online world and the ability for people to really write down some coherent thoughts and do some honest debate and put it all together online and have it ongoing. And one of the best blogs that's out there is the one written by my guest, Dr. Paul Spoudis from the Lunar and Planetary Institute in Houston. And he has continued to write these essays and these blogs and these columns for the Air and Space Magazine online and generated so much debate and good thinking. And some of the wackos are out there, too. Now, you put all that together. Ultimately, he's got this history of all this stuff, put it together in a book, which we're going to get to in just a second. But this sort of sets the stage for why Paul's on the show today, because a tremendous amount of thinking gone behind why we should go back to the moon and then documenting it through this blog, which has now become a book. And I think it's all very fascinating, and I wanted to have him on the program today. And so, again, courtesy of our friends up in Apogee Books, we bring Dr. Paul Spoudis to the show today. And Dr. Paul, how are you today?
I'm doing fine. How about yourself?
Well, doing wonderful. I know that's a long-winded introduction and didn't talk a little bit about you, but the first thing I got to ask you is my oldest son, who's about to graduate, he says to me, will you ask him if he saw the super full moon last weekend?
I did see it indeed, and it was quite spectacular. It's not something that occurs very often, but whenever you get the chance to, you should always take advantage of seeing the moon, and I do that whenever I can.
Well, and you see the moon, you've held the moon. It must be an amazing thing. Down here, by the way, we went for a drive right at sunset here on the Atlantic coast, and every beach, every parking lot was jammed full of people with their cameras in hand watching this thing rise off the water. It was really something else. But your interest in the moon goes way beyond that. Can you give us a little 30-second game show summary of your involvement with lunar research?
Sure. I mean, I've been interested in the moon for years, basically since high school when I watched the Apollo missions go to the moon. I studied it in college. I made it my principal object of scientific study. And I have believed for a long time that fundamentally the moon has a key role to play in human spaceflight and the expansion of humanity into space. And so when the vision was announced, as you mentioned, back in 2004, that was 7 years ago, I was very excited because I thought, finally, we've gotten a good strategic direction for the space program.
And of course, it hasn't quite worked out that way, and we still don't know where we're headed. But yet, along the way, you started documenting some of these things and some of these arguments and as you followed the space program, you put together this blog. And can you talk a little bit about how you wound up getting into that whole? It's not what your normal scientist sits around and does.
It turns out that I was the investigator of an experiment that flew to the moon on the Indian Chandrayaan 1 mission.
Right.
And that was launched in the fall of 2008. Tony Reichard, who's the editor of Air and Space, wrote me a letter and asked me if I'd be interested in blogging that launch for the magazine. And, of course, now I didn't actually know what blogging was at the time he called me.
Right.
That was only a little over 2 years ago. I did that. I wrote him email dispatches, which he posted on the website. And they were fairly popular, I guess, because when I came back, they asked me if I'd like to do this on a regular basis. And I've been doing it ever since.
And to me, the amazing thing about this is that the people respond. And now here you are several years later, and we've got this book in hand, Blogging the Moon, the Once and Future Moon Collection, again, published by Apogee. And to me, it's interesting because now we've come almost full circle. We used to write books about what we were interested in and trying to explain to people rationales for why we wanted to go in a certain direction or whatever. Now you've taken what's already been written online and collected it and edited it quite nicely, I might say, to take all the riffraff out of it. And here you have a book that's a result of what happened online. I used to preach that print was dead. And now
I think the book is handy because, for example, if you're on a trip, you're an airplane trip, you don't necessarily have connectivity to the web all the time. So this is a nice way to read a 1,000-word essay and then the discussion that follows it. They're nice bite-sized chunks of reading and at the same time, may perhaps learn something or find out something new about the moon at the same time.
Yeah, I again, to take the riffraff out of it, to take the personal name calling and even the fact checking, I think you did a really good job of making sure that what was in here was relevant and meant something. And it's also interesting to see some of the personalities of the people who continually responded to what you're saying. Some of them I think I recognize, but you didn't really go out of your way to identify or add biographies for everybody that contributed.
No, I've been pretty lucky with my readership. They tend to be very intelligent. They tend to be very well-informed. They don't always agree with everything I say. They take issue with it, which I want, and I want debate. Sometimes I'll terminate a discussion when it seems that we're just repeating ourselves.
Right.
But in general, I like the give and take of the discussion section. I think that allows us to explore the various aspects of individual ideas.
Well, now let's talk about the moon then. Let's get into that a little bit. First of all, I'm curious, even going back to more about your background in becoming a geologist, were you a space cadet first and then said, well, I need to be a geologist to study the moon?
Yes, that's exactly the way it went. I started off in engineering. I was an electrical engineer, and I switched my major to physics when I got interested in science, the science aspect of what NASA did. And it was during the Apollo 15 mission in 1971 when I got inspired to take up geology because of the amazingly fantastic performance of Dave Scott and Jim Irwin on that mission. They just did a superb job. They were test pilots, but they were actually excellent geologists, too. And I got turned on by geology. I read a couple of books, and I decided that was the way I wanted to pursue my interest in the moon.
You know, I had a geology course in college once, and I have still had a whole hard time connecting to it. But you know what? When I saw the Tom Hanks from the Earth to the Moon series, and the Apollo 15 episode, and they talk about going out to the various sites in New Mexico and Arizona to find these stories that these rocks tell, suddenly it became real much more interesting to me. And you've held these lunar rocks, and you know they all look the same to me. They all look the same to a lot of people, and they certainly don't look like they have as much water.
Well, each one tells a story, and the story they tell can be put together in increments to build up the history of the moon. The whole thing about water, that's sort of a separate story. We haven't actually held lunar water in our hands yet.
Right.
But we've done a number of experiments from orbit and from Earth-based observations that we're increasingly certain that there are significant amounts of water at both poles of the moon. And that has enormous significance for the future of humanity, not only on the moon, but in space itself, because I think a key thing that the moon offers us is the ability to create spacefaring capability from what we find in space, mm-hmm. rather than having to drag it all up with us from the deep gravity well of the Earth.
Oh, and I absolutely couldn't agree with you more. And it's those kind of things that are up there that we are still discovering that has to feed into this discussion about our space policy and where we're headed and when we're going to get there. And I want to address more of that with you, Dr. Spudas. We're going to have to pause here. We're going to take our five-minute built-in hold to get caught up on all the news, weather, and sports, and then come back, and we'll continue talking about this. In the meantime, I want to invite your phone calls, 768-1240, the local number, 321-768-1240, the long-distance number. spacetalking@aol.com is the email address. And, of course, you can find us on the web at WMMBAM.com, keywords space talk. All those different ways you can contribute and get in touch with us right now during the program. Give us your questions, your comments, whatever. And again, as we say, we'll be back in a few minutes. This is Space Talk, brought to you by Space Florida. I'm Jim Banky. You're listening to WMMB.
Now, back to our own mission specialist, Jim Banky.
And welcome back to our second half of Space Talk on WMMB, brought to you by Space Florida, committed to expanding Florida's aerospace enterprise. Well, we've been talking about going back to the moon today, something I believe we absolutely have to do as part of whatever it is we're going to do in our space program. I don't believe we can go to Mars or to the asteroids or anywhere else without doing some serious testing of systems and proving of systems and learning how to use the resources we have at the moon to make it easier on our space program. And Dr. Paul Spudas from the Lunar and Planetary Institute, author of the book called Blogging the Moon, the Once and Future Moon Collection, published by Apogee Books in Canada. Dr. Spudas is with us today from Houston. Again, sir, we welcome you back to Space Talk.
Thank you.
Good. Well, look, let's get into this talk about the moon and why you and I both think it's the place to go back to first. And if you would, we both reacted the same way to when President Obama, almost a year ago now, said, moon been there, Buzz has been there, we move on. And your blog in response to that was very, I think, right on, in saying that that was not just the typical been there, done that kind of an argument. And I'm wondering if you still think that that's true.
Well, yeah, I think the problem is that people have two different views of what the purpose of space exploration is. And I tend to look at it as a way of establishing a new realm of human endeavor. So effectively what we want is freedom of movement and freedom of action in this field of endeavor. And the current paradigm is that you design a spacecraft, you build it, you launch it, you operate it, and then you abandon it. And then you go back to square one, you repeat. So effectively what that means is that you're always limited to the biggest thing that can fit on the biggest rocket that you can launch. You can't build big distributed systems. You can't build large vehicles or installations in space. The way you do that is with multiple flights, and that the space station is a great example of that.
Right.
Now, the problem is that right now we're only limited to low Earth orbit with that kind of reach. So to extend human reach beyond low Earth orbit, you're going to have to work in a different environment. You're going to have to work with a different set of ground rules. And the reason that the moon is important is not so much to go and study it or explore it, although I'm certainly in favor of that, and I know a lot of great things you can do there. The real reason is to go there to learn how to live and work on another world, to use what you find there, to manufacture propellant, to create the consumables to support human life. All of those things are skills that a spacefaring people need to master. And what better place to master them than at a place that's close, accessible, and that we already know has what we need.
And how difficult is it to go up there and land at the South Pole and go into one of these craters that has all this water in it and pull out 8 ounces of fresh water?
Well, we don't know for sure how difficult it is. That's why we need to do it. That's why typically NASA and the federal government is involved in it, because fundamentally the unknowns are too great to answer through the private sector alone. So my attitude is basically we have a space program, we have a federal civil program, we have NASA, we're spending roughly $18 billion a year on it. We ought to get something in return for that.
Mm-hmm.
And in my mind, going to the moon and learning these skills, learning how difficult it is classically in line with an appropriate NASA activity.
Now, switching gears just a little bit here, one of the classic things that come up all the time in discussion with the moon is helium-3. And I'm wondering if what your thoughts are on that, and if you could explain a little bit about why that's always part of the topic of when we get into moon.
Well, it turns out there's a special isotope of helium. Helium-3 has one neutron instead of two neutrons, so it's a light form of helium. It's present on Earth, but in extremely rare amounts, vanishingly small amounts. It's present on the moon, also in small amounts, but in much larger abundance than is available on the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So the thought is that if you fuse a helium-3 atom with a deuterium atom, a form of heavy hydrogen,
right,
you get a fusion reaction that has no harmful radioactive byproducts. So it's a clean form of nuclear energy. And some have proposed that we go to the moon, mine it for helium-3, import that helium-3 back to Earth, and then burn it in fusion reactors here on the Earth to generate electrical power. Now, that's all in theory. The problem is we haven't yet achieved dehelium-3 fusion at least at commercial levels, beyond break-even. Collecting it is going to be a very challenging task. It's present, but it's present on the order of 20 parts per billion.
Wow.
And so you have to process a lot of regolith to extract a significant amount of helium-3 out of it. I think that ultimately someday it may become a viable alternative form of energy, but right now we don't have any use for it. The real gold on the moon that exists today, that we can use today, is the water, because water is extremely important not only to support human life, but also it when you break it down into its components of oxygen and hydrogen, it is the most powerful chemical rocket propellant we know of.
Sure. And not the least of which is the oxygen can be used to be breathed, and you can drink the water and all of that.
Well, and water is also a form of energy storage, because by changing it back and forth from liquid form to gaseous form and back again, you basically, it takes electricity or it gives off electricity. So you can effectively use it as a medium of energy storage as well.
What's in the regolith, and how would you compare that to, say, what you might be able to mine out of an asteroid? Are there heavy metals? Are there metals there that we could be using? There are,
but they're present in lower quantities than an asteroidal metal. I mean, the asteroids contain a lot of high-grade platinum group metals and siderophile elements, they're called. We have those on the moon, but they're not present in as great of concentration. A lot of the moon's siderophile elements are sequestered in its core, just like the Earth. And there aren't any significant magmatic processes that generate ore-forming mechanisms like there are on the Earth and the Moon.
Hmm.
So precious metals are not terribly abundant on the Moon. However, you can actually make pure native iron, that is reduced iron zero, out of lunar materials, and that stuff is very useful as a building material. It's very abundant in the lunar rocks. You can make it through a very simple industrial process. And when it's in pure form, made in a vacuum, it's very strong. It's stronger than stainless steel.
Wow, interesting. What about growing plants?
Plants apparently like to grow in the lunar regolith. When they brought the Apollo 11 samples back, one of the experiments they did in the receiving lab was to plant a variety of different terrestrial plants in them and observe the growth, and they did just fine. The big thing that we'll need on the moon, if we're going to grow food on the moon, is nitrogen, because that's a key thing, a key aspect of fertilizer.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it turns out that nitrogen is present in the polar cold traps. A lot of that comes from comets that hit the moon, and many comets contain a fairly large amount of nitrogen-bearing compounds.
Interesting. Now going back to the future, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter was our most recent probe to the moon.
And it's still working.
And it's still orbiting. It's still doing its thing. We did the crash on the moon and saw the water and enjoyed all that media coverage that week. I say only sarcastic a little bit because it drove me absolutely crazy what my how the media treated that and the public in many ways. But in any case, my question is, what do we still need to know? What should we still be looking for before we go back to the moon with humans? Let's say we're, I mean, just that's a given. Do we need more probes doing more things? What do we not know that we need to know?
Well, we have we have very high precision, high quality maps and remote sensing data of both the polar areas and in fact for most of the moon. What's really needed for the poles is detailed information on the physical state of the ice, the physical environment of the surface, on the surface, and the actual chemical and molecular composition of the water, of the ice and its other compounds. And the only way to get that is to actually send a rover to the poles that will go down into these dark areas and make in-situ analyses that will tell us very precisely what the conditions, physical conditions are there, what the physical state of the ice is, and what's there and in what abundance.
Now, what's your argument for going back to the moon right now? If we were to sort of sum up here a little bit. I mean, we know we want to use the in-situ resources. What's the argument, and to what extent, Dr. Spoutis, is the idea that, you know, we want to beat the Chinese there, or that we want to beat somebody else there? Is there another race sitting out there?
Well, there is, but it's not in the same sense that we understood it in the 60s. In the 60s, the space race was largely an argument about whose economic and political system was superior. The main reason that there is a space race now is to basically determine what the what economic political paradigm will prevail in
right.
space. So do you want a free market system based where people are able to create things and sell them at a profit and generate new wealth, or do you want a carefully controlled bureaucratic process where the actual amounts and quantities of things are tightly regulated by some central authority? Now, those are sort of two different operating principles. And fundamentally, my personal preference is I want the former, because that's generated the most wealth for the most people.
Sure.
If the United States is on the moon doing this, I think you can almost guarantee that something like that will prevail. It's not clear to me such a paradigm will prevail if someone else is on the moon. So that's sort of the argument for the fact that, yes, there is a race. It's just not in the same sense we understood before. But fundamentally, I think what's at stake is our ability to create a true spacefaring system. If we're continually stuck in the existing template that I mentioned before, where you launch one-offs from the bottom of the Earth's gravity well, you're always going to be mass and power limited, and therefore capability limited in space. I want those limits removed, and the way to make them unlimited is to use what you find in space. And to learn how to do that, we need to go back to the moon to use those materials and energy resources.
Well said. Dr. Spoutis, we're going to wrap up our coverage with you today. Author of Blogging the Moon, the Once and Future Moon Collection, a fascinating collection of essays for the past 3 years. Grab it online at space or at WMMBAM.com, keyword Space Talk. Dr. Spoutis, thanks for being with us. We're going to take a quick break here. Be back with an update from Space Florida and our launch forecast for the week. Be right back. This is Jim Banky. This is Space Talk.
And now back to Space Talk on WMMB.
Welcome back as we begin our final segment of today's edition of Space Talk, sponsored by Space Florida. Space Talk also brought to you today by the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex. Well, the snowbirds are here. Spring break is here. Your kids may be home for the week. When was the last time you visited the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex? Probably been too long from now, that's for sure. You can head on up there. Don't miss your chance. Meet an astronaut, walk beneath the Saturn V moon rocket. You can train in a spaceflight simulator. And you know what? There's still a launch coming up here from the Kennedy Space Center. All that possible at the Visitor Complex. Now for limited time, enjoy $5 off the price of admission. Just go online and visit kennedyspacecenter.com for all the details. Well, again, my thanks to Dr. Paul Spoutis from the Lunar and Planetary Institute in Houston. His book, Blogging the Moon, The Once and Future Moon Collection, is available from Apogee Books. It includes a bonus DVD, which has got some great slides and pictures in it that kind of complement some of the reading that you can do here. It's a fascinating book. The first time that I've seen an online blog begat an actual print book, ink on paper. Kind of a novel thought, if you ask me. So you can pick that book up at the, again, WMMB.com, keyword Space Talk, and then we'll have the link there to purchase it through Amazon. At this time, I want to invite Pat McCarthy, our friend from Space Florida, Director of Spaceport Operations, joins us here each week to let us know what our sponsor, Space Florida, is up to. Pat, how are you today?
Doing great, Jim. How about you?
Well, doing pretty good. I hurt my finger just before the show, and it's been bothering me the whole time.
So it's tough to punch up those buttons when you're answering calls and things, right?
That's right. I keep worrying. If I hit the 8-second dump line on you, it'd be just an accident. We'll get you back. But in any case, what's going on at Space Florida this week? What are you up to?
It's pretty cool this week. We've got a United Kingdom Trade and Investment Group that's coming into town for a trade mission. So they're bringing a bunch of aerospace and space companies from the United Kingdom, and we're going to match them up with Florida companies to help explore areas of collaboration in the future. I want to look at how they can expand or co-locate some of these mid-sized companies into Florida. And that's going to help them grow their business as well as bring in some new partners and new relationships here to Florida companies. We're doing matchmaking, so it's the whole Yentl thing, you know.
So they're coming in, and you're basically taking them around and introducing them to others as opposed to trying to sell them straight yourself.
That's correct. I mean, we're acting as the place to put them together, and we're going to take some tours of manufacturing and research facilities, you know, maybe probably the Kennedy Space Center, those kinds of things, so that they can look at what companies around here have to offer and how they might partner up with some of these UK investment companies.
How long did you say they're in town?
Most of the week. I think it's the 30th through April 1st. So there's a couple of panel sessions and things, and then everybody's going to make presentation on what they do, and then we're just going to turn them loose and let them get their one-on-one meetings and see what kind of agreements mm-hmm. they can sign up for partners.
How many people are involved?
It's on the order of 30-some companies that are going to be here. I think there's about 15 from the UK, and then there's at least that many, plus Department of Defense and NASA, as well as Space Florida from here in the state.
So we might see some Great Britain accents up and down the Space Coast this week. We want to put on our best foot forward, huh?
That's right. That would be smashing.
Gee, you practiced that, didn't you?
I have.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Anything else going on out there?
No, just want to remind you that, you know, Dr. Spoot is talking about lunar missions, and just recall that Lunar Prospector launched from Complex 46 when our predecessor organization was operating that.
That's true.
And Space Florida runs it now. You'll probably see some Google Lunar XPRIZE contestants launching from there in the future.
Wow.
That's going to just carry on that great heritage of lunar exploration that we already have from here in Florida.
Yeah, that pad is essentially ready to go again, or almost ready to go again?
Well, it's got a little bit of work to be done, but we've started that, and you know, probably within a year or so, it can be ready to support people like Athena or Taurus or some of the other vehicles that are out there, solid propellant vehicles.
Oh, that's outstanding. Good. Okay, well, Pat, we'll take that as your update for this week. We appreciate your time as always. And we'll talk to you again next week.
Thanks, Jim.
Okay, thanks. There goes Pat McCarthy, Director of Spaceport Operations for Space Florida. And let's see, let's move on to our weekly look at the launch forecast, which is brought to you by United Space Alliance. Innovation you can trust, performance you can count on. And we're still tracking down to launch of Space Shuttle Endeavour on its final mission, liftoff from the Kennedy Space Center. Still targeted now for Tuesday, April 19th at 7:48 p.m. The primary payload of the mission, the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer, was delivered out to the launch pad this week. And so operations are going right down the schedule as far as we can tell. No issues there. There was some discussion this past Thursday. They had the traditional media briefings for the flight. Before every shuttle launch, there's a day-long series of media briefings that the flight directors and the astronauts and the different payload people come out and talk about what's going to fly, and then it gives everyone a chance to prepare for the mission. Well, during those briefings, some of the folks representing the space station came out and said they're starting to look at the traffic control situation during that mission. Once Endeavour gets up, there's a Progress resupply vehicle that's supposed to come down a new one launch and then that new one dock. And, of course, NASA doesn't want any of that activity happening while the shuttle is docked. It's been kind of a hard and fast rule that you didn't want other ships docking. It has to do with not only the risk but stresses on the vehicle and all of that. Well, they're beginning to look at the possibility that the launch would slip or could slip based on what's the higher priority, and maybe there's a way that if you delayed Endeavour's launch a week, then you can get these Progress vehicles to do their little shuffle and then launch. There's also an idea that says you send Endeavour up on time, the Progress launches, and it just kind of loiters in orbit and waits its turn. The complicating factor is apparently there is a science payload of some kind on board this Progress ship that once it gets activated on the ground, it's only got so much time before it has to be on board the space station, and it's an important experiment. So they're having all those discussions, and nothing's changed yet. It's still April 19th, but I just bring it up because once you start seeing that kind of discussion trickle up into the media coverage, it gets to the point where, well, we ought to be aware of it and be thinking about it just in case. So that's the next launch for us, Tuesday, April 19th, 7:48 p.m. right at sunset time. Well, it looks like we're running out of time here. Next week, our guest will be John Logsdon, author of a book about John F. Kennedy's decision to go to the moon. You will not want to miss that, that's for sure. Space Talk is sponsored by Space Florida and is a production of Mylas Solutions. Aaron Michaels is my personal chief engineer for Space Talk. Up next on WMMB is the Home Mortgage Law Show, so do please stay tuned for that. I'm Jim Bankey, and we'll talk to you again real soon.